Okay, so like I was saying, I'm going to talk about cosmological constraints from probes of large-scale structure with the recent DES first-year analysis. So this combines galaxy clustering and weak lensing constraints, but I lead the weak lensing working group in DES, which is a group of about 150 scientists across the world. So I'm going to focus more on the weak lensing aspect of this, and in particular, how we make these weak lensing measurements possible. So in general, when we think about cosmology from large-scale structure, what we're trying to do is to distill the underlying matter field of the universe, the potential field, from different observations. And so you think about the large-scale universe, sure, there are large inhomogeneities, things like clusters of galaxies or galaxy halos in the dark matter field. But as you zoom out further and further, you get to a point where on the large scales, everything is statistically homogeneous, which means every part of the universe is basically the same as every other part in a statistical sense. So once we have an idea of homogeneity, we can construct a metric from GR, and this governs how we look at how the universe evolves. So this is an example. This is the Friedmann equation, which shows how the universe's scale expands over time, sometimes parameterized by the Hubble parameter, which is the expansion rate. And it is governed basically by what makes up the universe. And we think that the dominant part of that is some dark energy or vacuum energy or some cosmological constant component. And then after that, the part that makes up mass, the dominant part of that is dark matter. And we call these things dark matter and dark energy, because we don't observe them directly. Dark matter doesn't emit light or interact with electromagnetism. And we really don't know what they are. So this is a phenomenological model, which we call lambda CDM, because there's a dominant lambda component, cosmological constant, and dark matter, along with the rest, this small sliver that is everything that makes up us, baryons, neutrinos, etc. So the different components of the universe govern how the universe evolves, and we describe it by this model, which has only six parameters, and phenomenologically it does quite well at describing the universe. So this is what the evolution of the universe we think looks like. So you start at a period with inflation. There's a radiation-dominated area. So there are these components of this evolution equation: radiation, matter, curvature, and lambda. So we start out radiation-dominated. This is the surface of last scattering, where we observe the cosmic microwave background. There's a period of dark matter, of matter domination, where the universe's acceleration is slowing down. And then there's a period where it starts to speed up, where dark energy dominates the dynamics of the universe. And I want to point out two regions of this that are really important. One is the cosmic microwave background, which is a really strong probe of cosmology and has been very successful. And the other is the region of space that the dark energy survey probes, which is this dark energy dominated era at the late time. So at this point, someone should ask me how we actually learn about things we can't see or map visibly, and we actually can do this in a lot of ways. These are basically split up into two approaches. One is studying the expansion or the evolution of the scale of the universe, and the other is looking at the growth of structure or how matter evolves in clusters. And so there are a lot of ways we do this. The two that I'm going to talk about today is the CMB, which, like I said, has been so far the most powerful cosmological probe across the board. This is very sensitive to the expansion, but not at all sensitive to the evolution of growth of structure, which is a late time phenomenon. And the other is cosmic shear and galaxy clustering. This is what this cosmological analysis used to constrain cosmology with large scale structure. So how do we do this? We can't actually see where dark matter is because it doesn't interact with light. We can't observe it, but it does interact gravitationally. And we can see other things that interact gravitationally, namely baryons. So we look at these red points, which are the positions of galaxies. The size of the points correspond to how massive the galaxies are. And these galaxies, because they interact gravitationally and dark matter interacts gravitationally, they're coupled. And so where you find a galaxy, you're likely to find dark matter. And this is held up in simulations where you compare the hydrodynamical component, which is the galaxies, with the dark matter component. And you see the galaxies tend to trace the dark matter. They trace it up to some unknown function, which we call galaxy bias. So you can't actually pinpoint exactly where dark matter is using galaxies. But we can model this galaxy bias, and we can ask, what is the probability, this blue line, that we're going to find two galaxies at some separation? And we build a statistical construct of this. We call it a power spectrum or a correlation function. But this just tells us how much, what the probability is that you're going to find two galaxies or two masses of dark matter at some separation. And this has been very successful for many years. But we have to deal with the galaxy bias. So the other way we do this is with weak lensing or gravitational lensing. So if we want to know where mass is, the easiest way is to look at what its impact is on other things that we can see. So if you have a bunch of galaxies in this upper left square, they're not really those colors, but pretend. They're all spherical, and you put a heavy mass between you and those background galaxies, you're actually going to observe a lensed image that looks like this. And the shape of the lensed galaxies allows you to tell what the distribution of the mass is between you and the galaxies that cause the lensing. So you can directly measure the distribution and the amount of mass in the universe. And this is sensitive not just to baryonic mass, but to dark matter as well. So this is a really good way of mapping dark matter in the universe. The only problem is that galaxies are not actually circles. They actually have complex morphologies. They're elliptical. They're extended. And so if you lens something that is not spherical, you get a different image on the sky that you would measure. And if you tried to interpret the mass between you and these galaxies, assuming they were all spheres, you would get the wrong answer, which is why you require a lot of galaxies to do weak lensing analyses. So for the most part, galaxies are randomly oriented on a statistical scale, large scales. And so if you look at enough galaxies, enough lensed galaxies, you can reconstruct the mass of large-scale structure. This is not quite true. There is a small correlation in the distribution of galaxy orientations, which is what I spend a lot of my time working on, modeling this distribution of galaxy orientations. We call this intrinsic alignment, which is a contaminant, basically the largest physical contaminant to weak lensing. So this is what it looks like if you have a single massive structure. So this is lensing. You can see these arcs that look a lot like the previous picture. So this is an image of lensing by a cluster of galaxies that actually happens. We don't actually use this to do this analysis, though. We only find orders of thousands of lensing systems that produce strong arcs like this. What we do instead is we want to map the entire underlying matter field of the universe, where dark matter is everywhere in our field of view. And so what we do is we take galaxies at high redshift, and this red mass is a representation of the filamentary structure of dark matter that's between the galaxies that are emitting light and us observing them. And so as the light of these galaxies passes through all this large-scale structure in the universe, it gets deflected a little bit at every step in the way. And the final image that you map is actually the cumulative effect of all of those tiny distortions, all those tiny lensing events, of all of the large-scale structure along some line of sight. And so you can take the shapes of galaxies, these two galaxies here, for example, and you can ask, what is the probability that they have the same shape? That is, that they're lensed by the same distribution of matter along the line of sight, just like you've asked the probability that you'll find two galaxies at some separation. And you can build a correlation function or power spectrum from this. And this is actually a very strong way to map all of the distribution of large-scale structure along this line of sight. This is a relatively new phenomenon that was only measured for the first time in 2000 at very low signal to noise. And the analysis that I'm going to talk about today is basically the first time that this has been done to extremely high signal to noise. So we've really measured this to high significance. So these are two ways of mapping the dark matter field. One is looking at where luminous matter traces the field. The other is actually measuring the distribution directly through lensing, but you can also do the pairing of that. So instead of asking what the correlation of galaxy shapes is, or the weak lensing signal, you can ask what is the correlation of galaxy shapes around discrete points of mass. So you take a galaxy or a galaxy cluster and you ask what is the lensing signal around that particular point that you know a halo exists at. And we call that galaxy-galaxy lensing. And the combination of these three two-point functions, two-point correlation functions that we measure, we call 3x2-point for short. This is actually a combination of probes that maximizes information about the large-scale distribution of dark matter in the universe, while also allowing us to self-calibrate in a very robust way astrophysical and measurement systematics, like the galaxy bias and the intrinsic alignment. So we do this with the Dark Energy Survey. This is the collaboration, or one of the collaborations I'm part of. This is a 5-year, 5,000 square degree survey in the Southern Hemisphere using the Blanco telescope, which is shown here. This is the CCD array, what we call DE cam. It's a 570 megapixel camera mounted on the telescope. We have an approximately 3 square degree field of view, which has these 70 chips arranged like this. And we observe in GRIZY filters, which is not really important, except it tells us some resolution and frequency. This analysis is over the first year of data that we took in 2013, I think. But we are currently in our final observing year and working on analyzing the first 3 years of data. And this is just an example of what kind of picture you get out of the camera. This is pointed at the Small Magellanic Cloud. This is the collaboration. There are a lot of supporting institutions. There are about 500 participants in North America, South America, and Europe. And we've currently published around 140 papers, though that number is rapidly increasing. I currently have something like 20 submitted papers. So DES doesn't just do cosmic shear and galaxy clustering. It doesn't just probe large-scale structure. It was designed to look at all of these circle probes. So in addition to galaxy clustering, you can look at the lensing signal around galaxy clusters or the number count of galaxy clusters, which is a very powerful cosmological probe. And you can also look at BAO and supernova, which basically provide standard distances that you can use to probe the expansion rate of the universe.
Sorry, you don't have redshifts.
Right, so we have photometric redshifts, which are some probabilistic estimate of the distance of objects. And if you are good enough and select the right objects, you can actually get fairly fine precision. So the BAO measurement, for example, uses a very small set of galaxies compared to our total catalog that we can pin down the redshifts very well with just the 4 frequency estimates. So we have released cosmic shear and galaxy clustering cosmology. Cosmology from galaxy clustering, BAO, and supernova will happen over the next few months. So look forward to that. This is what our footprint looks like. So this is an image of the sky. This is the Southern Hemisphere. This is where the galaxy is on the sky. And this is the final kind of tank-looking shape of our final observing footprint. There are reasons why it looks like a tank that have nothing to do with it looking like a tank. This current analysis over the first year of data used this contiguous southern red region. And we're currently analyzing the third year of data, which covers the entire footprint. So I lead the weak lensing working group in DES. And weak lensing is, I think it's fair to say, the most difficult measurement to make in cosmology. This is a demonstration of what the kind of things that go into making a shape catalog are. And it's not really important to understand any of this. The only point of this is to make the next slides look less intimidating. But I do want to point out that there's a lot of work that goes into this, both at the data management level, which is the yellow boxes, and at the working group level, which is everything else. And that each of these steps can take millions of CPU hours and months of people, FTE equivalent time, to make this work. So this is really a massive effort to measure the weak lensing signal. So what are we actually doing when we measure weak lensing? So what we want is the original shape of the galaxy after it's been lensed. That's our goal. So we want to know what the lensing signal of a galaxy is. So you have some intrinsic galaxy that looks like this, and it experiences a shear. That is, the gravitational lensing of foreground masses distorts it a little bit. This is way over exaggerated. The effect is actually on the order of a percent. So not visible by eye, only visible statistically. So once you have a shear to a galaxy, the light passes through the atmosphere, and it passes through your telescope. And that causes what we call a point spread convolution. And it basically smears it out. So you lose all of the fine resolution of the galaxy that you would see from space. And then when you measure it with your CCD, it's pixelized. And there's some shot noise from photons, from photon noise. And so this is what you get to look at. And you want to reconstruct the difference between these two images. Nature has kindly given us point sources in the form of stars. They have no physical extent on the sky, effectively. And so any shape you measure for a star is this convolution from turbulence in the atmosphere and your telescope components. And so we can create a model of the PSF and back out from these steps to measure the shear. So this is a nice galaxy image from our telescope. You can probably draw pretty well what the shape of that galaxy is. The problem is that there are only a few galaxies like that, relatively few. The galaxies that we actually want to measure are like right here. And the point is that you can't see that. This is a blown up version of that portion of the sky. This is an actual galaxy that we would measure the shape of, one of about 30 million. This is what it looks like in a better view, pixelated. So there's some masking that removes neighboring light. And then we fit this second line, some model, to this image. And this is actually a really nice galaxy, high signal to noise. You can actually tell there's an object there. Most of the time, you can't even see the object by eye. And the difference in basically how precisely we have to measure this shape is the difference between the second and third row. So the third row is the same model, but I've introduced a catastrophic bias. It would give us completely the wrong cosmology. And of course, you can't see the difference by eye. You can only see the difference when you accumulate the signal of about 30 million galaxies. So shape measurement often feels a bit like this. This is a fun picture from a recent weak lensing workshop that we hosted. Basically, everything you can think of is correlated with the shear of a galaxy. And it's really hard to get it right. So for the first year of data, this was about 1,500 square degrees of the final 5,000 square degrees of the dark energy survey. We have produced not one, but two fully calibrated, independently produced shape catalogs. This is really important because of the last slide. There are a lot of ways that you can mess up the shape measurement. There are a lot of things that are correlated with the shape and produce systematics. And really, the only way to figure out that you've done something wrong is to do it twice and find a difference. So this is what we did. We are the first survey that has produced multiple shape pipelines to verify that we get the same result. The first one uses a completely new, novel calibration method that doesn't require image simulations. This produced 34.8 million galaxies. This is a factor of 2 in the next largest shape catalog. So we're really pushing the boundaries of this field, and a factor of 4 in the area of the next best cosmic shear catalog. We use shapes combining shapes. We measure shapes combining information from RI and Z bands. So we triple the number of the signal to noise, basically, by remeasuring the galaxy in multiple wavelengths. And this is compared to this other catalog, M3 shape, which is unchanged from our science verification analysis, which is kind of a pre-survey period where we figure out whether we can actually do what we promised the funding agencies we can do. This catalog produces 21.9 million galaxies using only information in the R band and requires calibration by image simulations. So we take a space image of a galaxy, a bunch of images from Cosmos, from the Hubble Space Telescope, and we propagate all the things that happen with our real telescope in a simulation, and we measure what the shape we recover is, and this tells us how wrong the shape measurement method is, basically. So I would emphasize that the catalogs are groundbreaking, but not just because they're so large and they cover such a large area, but in the quality of our reconstruction of the calibration, which I think is fairly unprecedented at this number density. So if you remember, this is what the red region looked like in the previous footprint plot. This is the number density, the distribution of objects across the sky that are in our weak lensing catalog. There are some small fields in the middle. Those are what we call supernova fields. Those are the fields that we observe over and over again on a cadence of about 7 days to identify supernova. And then there's a portion in Stripe 82, which overlaps with Sloan's Edge of the Sky survey. And then this is the part that we use to do cosmology with. So once you have the shapes of all of these galaxies, so every galaxy in this plot we have a shape estimate for, you can use that to reconstruct the lensing signal across the footprint. And that tells you information about all the mass along the line of sight. And so we can take this information. Oh, I was getting ahead of myself. This is just to show that we did a lot of tests to understand that things worked well. This is not important except that these lines should be flat. That is, we're taking some quantity that isn't correlated with any cosmological information and asking whether we see a signal. We don't see a signal, which is good. And we are producing better shapes than we did in the science verification period. That is, we're recovering more shapes as a function of the total number of objects observed. And this is the redshift distribution of those objects. So you rightly pointed out that we don't have spectroscopy. We don't have an SED for any in particular object. What we do instead is we take 4 points along the spectrum at different wavelengths, and we estimate the SED from that and guess basically what the redshift is of each object. That's why these bins are not square. So these are the shape catalog objects. There are 4 redshift bins that we used for the cosmology analysis. There are 5 redshift bins for the lenses. Those are the galaxies we use for clustering to trace the dark matter field. So we use the shapes of 26 million galaxies. That's the part in the lower region of the previous footprint plot. That covers an extent of 1,321 square degrees. This is a factor of 2, I mentioned before, larger than the next best shear catalog. So we're getting significantly better signal noise in our cosmology. And the galaxies we use for clustering, I mentioned that, for example, the BAO sample, we select a very specific set of galaxies that we can reconstruct the redshift very well with. We do the same thing here. We use 600,000, 600,000 out of 130 million. So we're really picking the best of the best galaxies for reconstructing the redshift by matching them to red sequence templates. So these are galaxies we think are on the red sequence, and so we can tell very well what their redshift is based on their colors. And that's important because if you have good redshifts for your clustering sample, you can self-calibrate the much worse PhotoZs for your lensing sample. So this is what I was trying to say before. Once you have the shapes of all these objects in the footprint, you can reconstruct the lensing signal, basically the mass along the line of sight at every position in the footprint. And you can produce something that looks like this, which is a map of all of the dark matter along every line of sight that we've observed with the first year of data. So this is actually the distribution of dark matter in the universe in this region of the sky, where blue regions have a higher than average density, and brown regions have a lower than average density. So you can see something like a supercluster here and a very big void here in the dark matter distribution. This is the largest dark matter map ever produced from a low redshift survey, which is pretty exciting. So once you have this map of what the distribution of mass in the universe is, you can actually do cosmology.
Sorry, question. Yep. So what do you mean by low redshift survey as opposed to, you need a bigger map from a higher redshift survey?
Right, so if you take the CMB, for example, you can measure lensing of the CMB photons by foreground maps.
That's what you mean by that.
Yeah, yeah. Basically from a galaxy survey that isn't the CMB. So one of the 2 components of the cosmology analysis is this distribution of dark matter. And we can produce cosmological constraints from this. And we do this through a combination of these 3 two-point functions that I mentioned. So we are looking at the correlation of all these shapes, or the correlation of the density of dark matter at every position in this footprint. And that tells us how structure has evolved. So we have this not just as a function of area on the sky, but we have it as a function of time as we go backward in redshift. So we measure this lensing signal. We reconstruct the mass as a function of redshift in position on the sky. And we produce this correlation function, which is the measure statistically how probable it is to find some structure at some scale. This is just to show you what the correlation function looks like. It's very high signal to noise, about 26. This is compared to our science verification efforts, which was like a signal to noise of 10. So we're really pushing the limits of signal to noise in this measurement.
These are different redshifts?
Right, yeah. So these are the angular scale, the separation of each object. And each of these panels is a different redshift bin pair. So this is, for example, the correlation between objects in the first and third redshift bins. And so you get a lot of information if you do this cross-correlation between different redshift bins. And it really allows you to pin down things like the intrinsic alignment signal. So this is the logarithmic. The signal is very logarithmic. So we usually show it like this. You can also plot it linearly by multiplying by the angular extent. And you get something that looks like this. So the solid line is the best fit cosmological model prediction. And the data points are the measurements that we get from the meta-calibration catalog. And I said that we had two shape catalogs. So we did this process twice. So you can flip back and forth between these. This is the measurements for the smaller catalog. And if you flip back and forth, they agree really well. This was my favorite activity for about a week after we first looked at the measurements. This is really impressive. No one has ever demonstrated that you can do something this well.
So remind me.
Yeah.
So what is psi minus?
Right. So because we're measuring a spin 2 object, the ellipticity or shape of an object, you end up with three correlation functions when you do the correlation, the statistical measurement. And the two of them that are non-zero are psi plus and psi minus. This is basically, you take, so you have two shapes, and you ask, in this line of sight connecting them, what is the tangential component of this shape and the radial component relative to this object? And so psi plus is the sum of those two components, and psi minus is the difference, which is why psi minus is so much smaller.
Sorry, what was the difference between the two slides? Is this and the previous one that you flashed? Yeah.
Right. So these are two completely independent shear estimates.
Okay. It's the same data, but
yes. So this is what the signal looks like for galaxy clustering. That is how probable it is to find two galaxies at some separation, also in different redshift bins. Galaxy clustering is much more localized than weak lensing, and so there is essentially no signal between redshift bins. And this is the same thing for the galaxy-galaxy lensing signal. That is the tangential component of the shear around the lens positions, the galaxy positions. And in all of these, the model fits quite well. And so we take these measurements, and we can probe cosmology with them.
So when you say the model fits well,
yes.
You know, it wasn't chi squared.
Right. That's a good question that no one ever asks. So the chi-squared, the reduced chi-squared, the chi-squared per degree of freedom in the published version of these results was around 1.3. For a lot of degrees of freedom, around 800. So 1.3 is actually quite bad.
Yeah.
Right? This is something that we've been working on. We have discovered a slight modification in the covariance that we should have made. When you do the covariance, our covariance is analytic. We don't actually do jackknifing or simulations. Our data vector is around 800 points long, so we can't produce enough in-body simulations to do the covariance.
Linear scales, I thought, was the idea.
Yes.
So presumably, it's like almost Gaussian covariance, so it should be.
For the shear signal, they are Gaussian.
Right.
So we calculate them analytically. There is a non-Gaussian contribution for the other two correlation functions. We have made the assumption that we had an idealized footprint, basically a footprint without boundaries in the analytical calculation. And this was borne out by tests we did using simulations that it didn't shift the cosmology and didn't change the size of the contours very much. In fact, we didn't look at the chi-squared, and it turns out that it does affect the chi-squared, whether you make that approximation or not. So we've rerun the analysis. This will be in the second archive version, where we actually take into account the number of pairs of objects as a function of scale. That gives us a window function for the survey. And it changes the covariance slightly and reduces the chi-squared to 1.09, which is completely acceptable. It doesn't change the cosmology, though.
How much? 800 degrees of freedom. How much data are you fitting data points?
It's about 800 data points, yeah. On order 700 to 800. Yeah.
So you're actually learning something.
Yeah. You look like you have another question.
That your previous estimate of the covariance matrix was wrong by like 50% or something.
So the diagonal component of the covariance matrix was off by about 10%. But
you
that
said 1.1 squared versus 1.3 squared.
Yep.
So it's not like 0.4, 0.4.
It doesn't take much. It doesn't take a large change in the covariance to do that.
So are you fitting the gray area or not? Because it looks like you're fitting the gray area, and those are the nonlinear things then.
Right, so this is another thing I didn't mention. The gray region are the nonlinear scales that we don't include in the fit. So
it looks like you do include, because you're not including it.
Right, so the model fit comes only from the non-shaded region, and we're just showing what it looks like in the shaded region.
So the 800 data points are just the white regions, how do you think? Okay.
Yep. So this was a technical change of the covariance that doesn't change the cosmology or the area of the contours to any significant degree, but it does strongly impact the chi-squared. So we've updated that. I can talk more after about why it doesn't take that much of a change to fix this. Okay, so now that you have the measurements, you can actually infer cosmology from them using the unshaded regions of the data vectors. So we're combining these different probes of the underlying matter field, these three two-point functions. I think I mentioned this already, but this is the most significant detection of cosmic shear to date at 27 sigma. One important thing to talk about before we look at the results is that it's really important when you have very tight cosmological constraints from things like Planck, the CMB, that you not bias yourself, particularly in something like WCDM, where you allow the dark energy equation of state to vary. There's a very specific value of the dark energy equation of state that is special, -1, which is a cosmological constant. You don't want to stop testing when you get a result that is W of -1. So we do a two-stage blinding process. That is, when we measure the shears for each object, we actually measure them systematically wrong in a way that no one knows beforehand, but can back out later through a process. So the signal that we measure is wrong. So any tests we do, this blinding doesn't impact the results of any null tests we would do, but it does change the cosmology that we derive. So before we do the unblinding, we can't know what the actual result would be. We also, in addition to this, blinded all individual results. So every output of a cosmological parameter or a chain, an MC chain, was also modified in a recoverable but unknown way. And so until the very end, we had no idea what the results would be, which makes you work very hard. It's a little more stressful, but is also very exciting at the end. I mentioned that we had two different shape measurement pipelines, two different shape measurement calibrations. We did this for basically every core component of the analysis. We had two shape pipelines. We had two redshift calibration methods. That is how we calibrate the redshift distributions. We had two analysis pipelines. That includes the theory modeling and the parameter estimation. And we had two parameter sampling methods. This all resulted in a set of what was 19 papers when I started giving this talk. It's now 13 papers, over 300 pages of results on the archive that was released in August. And there are still more to come. So this is what the cosmology analysis looks like. So lambda CDM has 6 cosmological parameters, +1 if you include the dark energy equation of state. We also included a varying neutrino mass density because we don't actually know what the neutrino mass is. This is something that most cosmology analyses ignore. So in total, we had 7 or 8 cosmological parameters, whether we did lambda CDM or WCDM. I mentioned the galaxy bias up here and intrinsic alignment. These are two physical phenomena that we have to model. And together, they contribute 7 astrophysical parameters. And we don't do things perfectly, of course. We don't measure the redshifts perfectly or the shapes perfectly. And so we create a parameterization of what we think the uncertainty on those calibrations could be. And those parameters contribute 13 systematic parameters. And so we vary all of these parameters simultaneously in order to reconstruct the 7 or 8 cosmological parameters.
So, quick question. Yep. Do you cross-target different galaxy redshift bins or not?
Yes.
You do, okay.
So the data and analysis testing and validation, basically all this work extended for more than 2 years. It was a long process. It's a very difficult process. And for the first time, we saw the results on July 7th. That's when we unblinded. We unblinded in a live telecon. So there were about 100 people from the collaboration that called in video conference. And we showed the results to everyone at the same time. It was a really exciting moment to see the results. And the impressive thing is that 27 days later, it appeared on the archive. So when we unblinded, we were absolutely sure. All that happened after that was updating the values in the papers and publishing. So in addition, so we don't just do this analysis varying these 20-something parameters once. We actually do it around 50 times. So it's possible that for example, our modeling of the intrinsic alignment signal is not flexible enough. And you want to confirm that if you included more flexibility, it wouldn't bias your cosmology or change your results. And so we go through this process with a whole range of different ways of modeling things, both systematics and astrophysical and cosmological things. And the only thing that you should take away from this is that all the points lie within the gray region, which is our fiducial result. So we're very robust to every possible variation that we could think to test in our analysis. This is for the cosmic shear. Said we had two shape catalogs and two photo Z calibrations, so we can ask what is the difference in recovered cosmology for those two results. So these are contours. The larger contours are from cosmic shear alone, and the smaller contours are from the combination of the three two-point functions, and they all agree very well. So we have strong internal consistency in our independent reconstruction of the data quantities.
So I could have a question.
Yep.
So that reduced chi-square, how much does that change for these different methods of shape, do you think?
The reduced chi-square was not very different between them, yeah. It was really due to the covariance thing. So the other thing, because we're looking at the dark matter field in three independent ways, you can construct two ways of actually probing cosmology from that. One is with cosmic shear alone, and one is with the combination of galaxy clustering and galaxy-galaxy lensing. Those both produce comparable constraints on cosmology. And you can ask whether they give you the same cosmology. And in fact, they do. This is actually the first time that a survey has successfully done this and gotten the same result. It's been attempted once before, and they got different results. So clearly, there's some internal tension in the data there that doesn't exist in our results.
So who is that? Sorry.
This is the KIDS collaboration.
Yeah.
So once we know that the individual components, the different ways of looking at the matter field agree, we can combine them all. And that gives us the blue constraint here. So this is our final constraint from large-scale structure on cosmology, and this omega m, which is the matter density, and S8, which has to do with the amplitude of the clustering signal. So internally, we're consistent. But we're not the only way to constrain cosmology. I mentioned that the CMB also does it very well. And so we can keep getting tighter and tighter parameter constraints, but that gets a little boring. What we're actually after is testing our fundamental understanding of the universe. So wouldn't it be great if we could take two points in the universe, 6 billion years apart, and ask whether they predict the same cosmological model, whether you can write a cosmological model that is consistent between them. So we take cosmological results from the cosmic microwave background, 400,000 years after the Big Bang, and the dark energy survey results, which are about 6 billion years after, and we ask whether they're consistent. And this is really strong, a really strong test, because these are completely different regimes of the universe. The CMB is at redshift 1100. It's a radiation-dominated part of the universe. There are no structures. There are no stars or galaxies. The fluctuations in the potential field are on the order of 10 to the minus 5. And you fast forward 6 billion years, and you have what we measure. There are galaxies, clusters of galaxies, lots of messy astrophysics. The perturbations are order 10 to the 6 larger. And we can compare these two. And it turns out that they are consistent. So lambda CDM with these two probes, which are actually producing comparable constraints in this clustering mass space, give the same result. They're consistent within the same cosmological model, which is incredibly impressive.
Talked about tension on H sub 0.
Yes, I have a slide about that coming up. So this is basically in the parameter space that has to deal with the matter evolution, the evolution of structure. They're consistent. Not only that, but when we ask, DES is not the only low redshift constraint. There are BAO and supernova results from low redshift. If we combine all of those, we get this blue contour. And again, compared to the high redshift CMB constraints, again, they're consistent at the same level. They're actually more consistent than DES and the CMB alone. And so there's overall a very nice picture here that Lambda CDM is working across vastly different times and regions and compositions of the universe. So once these all, basically, if two data sets give contradictory cosmologies, you can't combine them, obviously. But since they do give the same cosmology, they're consistent with each other, we can combine them. And this is the tightest cosmological constraint ever produced by combining Planck, BAO, supernova, and our DES large-scale structure cosmology. So going back to your question about H-naught, so this, I didn't mention this, but this agreement is actually really important because previous weak lensing results, some subset of previous weak lensing results, claimed some tension between weak lensing results and the CMB. And we're not finding that that's significant for us.
But you're also consistent with that.
Yes, we're in the middle. Yes. The other thing that people talk a lot about is inconsistency in the expansion rate of the universe from high redshift and low redshift probes. We really should have said what these are. Holy cow is a cluster constraint on H-naught. Shoes is a supernova constraint. SPT, Pole, and Planck are CMB constraints. And then the top one is ours combined with Big Bang nucleosynthesis constraints. So if you take the shoes result and the Planck result, they look very discrepant. And so these were the first two things that were popularized. They claimed a discrepancy of around 3 sigma. But now we have 5 different independent constraints on H-naught, not just the CMB and low redshift supernova. And when you take these in together as 5 random draws of the same cosmology, we find that they are actually consistent at around 2 sigma. So there is not, I wouldn't jump up and down yet. If it continues, if we have other constraints that agree with Shu, then it might be more significant. But for now, just like the clustering amplitude, we're finding general consistency in Lambda CDM with H-naught as well. The final H-naught value that we get combining all these data sets is 69.1. Some other highlights from the analysis. I mentioned that we varied both Lambda CDM. I was only showing you Lambda CDM results. We also varied the dark energy equation of state. And we actually find that there is no evidence for a non-cosmological constant W. That is, there's no better fit to the data by allowing W to vary. So for now, everything is consistent with a cosmological constant. When we combine DES with Planck, you can see this here. It actually shifts the recovered H-naught more than 1 sigma toward the low redshift supernova constraint, which is why these are less significant. And we also relax the neutrino mass density constraint. So because cosmological probes can place an upper constraint on the neutrino mass, while experiments place a lower constraint on the neutrino mass, and eventually they'll meet and say some interesting things about what neutrino physics there are. But when we combine our data, because we prefer a lower omega m and S8 than Planck, we actually relax this constraint by about 20%. And these are the specific values that are probably most interesting, W, S8, and omega m. And you might notice that W is exactly minus 1. So if I told you that I measured W minus 1 to 3 significant digits, you shouldn't believe me, unless I tell you that I didn't know the answer before I did the analysis. So this is really why the blinding process is important. So we can learn not just about cosmology with these probes. So I mentioned 2 astrophysical things that we model. One is the galaxy bias, and the other is the intrinsic alignment or orientation of galaxies in weak lensing. So typically people use the clustering signal, W of theta, with a fixed cosmology to infer the galaxy bias. And that's what these blue points are in error bars. You can also do it with gamma T, the tangential shear or galaxy-galaxy lensing with fixed cosmology, that's red. But for the first time, we are able to not just vary all 26 of these parameters, we are able to vary all 26 of these parameters, astrophysical, systematic, and cosmological, and get a constraint in black from this joint probe analysis that is almost as good as if you fix the cosmology and use the clustering signal to measure the galaxy bias, which is really exciting. You can also ask what the amplitude of the correlation of intrinsic shapes of galaxies are. So galaxies, when they form in some tidal field, and they tend to align along the gradient of that tidal field. And so you get correlations in the intrinsic non-lens shapes of galaxies. We can constrain these as well. So the points up here above zero are just different ways of parameterizing the intrinsic alignment model. With all of these, we get a consistent amplitude of this intrinsic alignment. And something, our data set is in fact so powerful that for the first time, we were able to measure the intrinsic alignment of a certain class of galaxies called blue or spiral. So these are galaxies whose shape are spin supported as opposed to pressure supported. We actually find for the first time a detection of non-zero alignment in those galaxies as well, which is really interesting in a structure formation kind of sense, non-cosmological. So those are all really exciting results. But this is really just the beginning for large-scale structure and weak lensing. So as we go forward with DES, the data set that we're analyzing now, the first 3 years of DES data, this triples, more than triples, the footprint from our year one observations, which should give a corresponding root 3 improvement in cosmological constraints. So we're going from 35 million galaxies in our shape catalog to 90 million. And that will increase again when we include all 5 years. Because the integrated exposure time will more than double, which allows us to go deeper to higher redshifts. The other thing to note is that DES, the current analysis, used just 3% of the sky. This is compared to the CMB, which is using all of the sky already. The final year five results will use 1/8 of the sky for DES, but there are already projects being built now that will cover half of the sky with weak lensing measurements. These include LSST on the ground, and WFIRST and Euclid in space. Another thing we're currently working on is to extend the study of cosmology to non-lambda CDM, so things that include non-zero spatial curvature, evolving dark energy models, and modified gravity, so fundamentally testing general relativity. By the end of DES, this is the kind of increase in constraint we're looking at from the previous state of the art. And looking forward to LSST, WFIRST, and Euclid, this is a plot of basically the detection limit, or how deeply these surveys can observe. And this isn't really important, except to put it in perspective, DES is up here. So we're looking, this is a logarithmic scale, we're looking at orders of magnitude improvement in detection efficiency with these upcoming experiments, which are going to completely blow DES out of the water. And really learn, really show us, teach us a lot about the universe. So just to summarize, we've used large-scale structure in DES very successfully. This is the second time someone has attempted this constraint, the first time with internal consistency. And we have produced constraints that rival the CMB in terms of the low redshift prediction of the clustering and matter density. We find that lambda CDM is consistent with all current probes of the universe, and no evidence for a W that isn't cosmological constant, or W not equal minus 1. And as I just said, this is really exciting and is going to change rapidly over the next 10 years as these future surveys turn out and DES completes the year 3 and year 5 analyses. So thank you very much.
So on your slide for the intrinsic alignments, yep. Where you showed this negative result for the blue galaxies.
Right.
What does that mean?
Right. So all previous detections of the intrinsic alignment of galaxies have been for pressure-supported red light galaxies, bright luminous, LRGs, luminous red galaxies. And these have a positive amplitude. And what that means is a radial alignment with the tangential, so basically, you have some galaxy here. The lensing is a tangential distortion of shapes behind this object. the intrinsic alignment signal, because it's along the gradient of the field, is radial. And so in this sign convention, radial is positive.
Oh, so this is a GI correlation you're talking about.
Yeah.
Opposites. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is that the spin or angular momentum of supported galaxies have an opposite net alignment, which makes things even more complicated because lots of positive and negative contributions that compete with each other and compete with the positive lensing correlation.
Do you learn anything about the 84-year-old problem? What is that dark matter stuff?
Yeah, that's the thing that gets thrown under the rug at these talks. Lambda CDM is a really great phenomenological model, but we don't actually know what the components are. We don't know what dark matter or dark energy really is. And DES right now has not told us anything beyond better constraints on the parameters. That may change with the year 5 data, but it may take the upcoming surveys like LSST. I think that what we really need to better understand these kinds of fundamental things is better distance resolution or time resolution in the constraining these quantities. For example, whether we can detect an evolving dark energy equation of state, and that really requires the kinds of number densities and cadence that surveys like LSST will provide.
One thing you learn is getting from delta 10 to the minus 5 recombination to something much greater than 1.
Yeah.
You can't do that with
variance. Yeah. Yeah. It certainly requires some component that is like what we think of as dark matter.
The question is, there seems very little room for W varying. This must rule out dark energy modified gravity stuff.
Right. So the implication that we have this very tight constraint on W close to minus 1 is that there isn't a lot of freedom. I'm not particularly optimistic that we'll find a different result when we allow the dark energy to vary with time. We are looking now at constraining modified gravity models. I don't know. Hopefully in the next few months we'll have definitive answers for all those things. Those are things that are happening right now.
So I'm not sure if you've thought about this or others in the collaboration. You could also do like model-independent dark energy history or things like that sort, because there's absolutely nothing fundamental about this W parameterization. So
right.
The fact that it's minus 1 or plus 1, it doesn't really tell you anything.
Yeah, so one of the things along with modified gravity models that we're looking at is different parameters.
Those are also equally at heart.
But
the question is, can you do something model-independent?
Right, so we're doing a version of this where we just allow principal components, fitting principal components of the W. That's something that will happen. That's planned for this follow-up analysis as well.
I was wondering how far into the nonlinear regime do you use modes, and how do you decide where to stop?
Right, so it depends on which measurement. So for cosmic shear, there is some fundamental limit, which is how well we can predict or model the nonlinear matter power spectrum, which is much less than this gray boundary. The gray limit here for cosmic shear comes from the impact of baryons, baryonic feedback on the dark matter power spectrum. So we require for the most extreme baryon model, which comes from the OWLS AGN simulation, that the contribution to the correlation function is less than 2%, which completely renders it negligible for our constraints. And so that's where these boundaries come from. For galaxy clustering, this is where the nonlinear bias is expected to start to be to contribute. And so you would have to, if you go below this scale, you would have to model something about the nonlinear contribution to the bias. You would have to either have a B2, a nonlinear bias term, or fit something about the mass of the halos. For galaxy-galaxy lensing, there is a constraint from nonlinear bias as well, but the cutoff is actually higher here because we're using gamma T, the tangential shear, which is a non-local estimator. It integrates the mass all the way to the center of the halo. And so there are non-local effects that we're not modeling due to this estimator that cause us to choose this cutoff. So one of the things that we're improving for the next analysis to either not use gamma t or to use gamma t and somehow model these non-local contributions so we can go to smaller scales. We're also looking at actually marginalizing over some set of baryon models to lower the scales in cosmic shear as well. Because as you go to higher, basically, as you increase the density by a factor of three, your precision goes up, and so you have to cut out more scales to not be biased. And so we're going to have to deal with these things. But for this year, for this analysis, we chose something that was the most conservative linear analysis that we could do. And the next round, we're pushing those boundaries lower.
You also have to worry about your ability to model it.
Right. We don't have to worry about that as long as we're worrying about baryon still. But there is a strong uncertainty at small scales about inter-halo, one-halo contributions to the intrinsic alignment signal that aren't modeled well with the models that we fit in the current analysis. Yeah.
So do I understand correctly that these caps are all linear theory?
They are all.
Or are the halo model?
They include contributions from the halo model.
So the halo
yeah. Right.
Okay. So then additional parameters in them. Right, like, I don't know, the halo model has
to be. The halo model has some parameters fit to simulations.
Yeah,
we don't allow them to vary. We assume that they're fit to whatever the implementation of the halo model we use has measured from simulations.
Right. So that's a little bit tricky because, of course, those are calibrated.
Right. There's some uncertainty to those fits. And so at some region that is down here, that starts to matter. So if we were to say we could model the baryons, there would still be some scale that we would have to cut off because of uncertainty in these calculations for the nonlinear matter.
Okay. So related to that, then have you tried just this as like a Mark catalog?
Yes. Okay. So this is one of the papers that hasn't been put out yet. It's taken a long time because there were issues in our simulations that we found by trying this. But the other thing that we did was do this entire analysis on a complex in-body simulation with ray tracing and everything to demonstrate that we could reproduce the correct cosmology. And it turned out that we found a stochastic bias in the simulation that we didn't think was reasonable. And so we spent a lot of time iterating, trying to fix that in the simulation. But it is, we were able to reproduce the cosmology, the right cosmology in a full analysis on in-body simulations. Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit disconcerting.
The stochastic bias, yeah.
I mean, if it's in the simulation, it could be in the real world as well.
We can talk about
it.
It's not in the snapshots, so it's not a fundamental thing. It's something that we think has gone wrong along the way.
Okay.
Yeah. We have two sets of in-body simulations. One doesn't have this problem, and we did this on both, and both of them up to the stochastic bias, and one produced the right cosmology.
So if you go ahead two slides, what does it mean when, so some of these look like really bad fits and it looks like the points are, the
right.
points are correlated?
So
is that like the top middle?
3-1, right, yeah.
Yeah.
So it looks really bad. In fact, there is very little signal in these bin pairs where the first index is larger than the second. These are pairs where the galaxies are in front of the lenses, so there is no lensing. And in fact, the chi-squared, even if you just take the chi-squared of that fit, it's actually not that bad because all the points are so strongly correlated.
So the points shown here are strongly correlated?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because there are a bunch of other ones like 4-3 where this yeah. same thing comes up where I have some systematic offset or 3-2.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we looked specifically into these, especially 3-1, because it looks really weird. And we don't think there's anything. Yeah.
So I'll ask one more question. There's this really impressive roadmap of future experiments that will be LCC, orders of magnitude resistance. What is your personal guess for at what point the system arithmetic errors will become part of the quality of these statistical errors. And what do you guess the systematic might be?
Right. So I'm hoping it won't be the year three DES analysis. We actually have improved a lot of things that were not so great about the shear measurement in this round already. We have a much better shear catalog across all 5,000 square degrees already. The redshifts are trickier. Redshift measurement is not as advanced as our shear measurement. So moving forward to LSST, I think that getting unbiased redshift distributions and being able to model the intrinsic alignment signal to high enough accuracy as a function of scale, not just amplitude. Those, I think, are probably the two biggest things we have to worry about. The meta-calibration method that we developed for this work is actually, it's a really big thing for shear measurement. It basically reduced our errors by a factor of 3. And we already think that the meta-calibration framework is good enough for LSST level accuracy, up to some questions about neighbor bias. I think it probably won't be our constraint on the bias of the shear, but rather photo Z's and things that they feed into, like the intrinsic alignment.
Okay.
Thank you.